So last week I showed an opening clip from The Princess Bride and went to my men's group, found out that I wasn't the only one whose wife then made them watch the movie after coming home. Is anybody else there as well? Yeah, okay, a couple of y'all. I apologize for making you have to have a nice night with your wife. I'll see what I can do about not doing that in the future. Since NCAA tournament is going on right now, I thought maybe we might start off something this morning to help you kind of move you to where we'll end up or at the end of the message. If we were to do a seeding or a ranking, so if you don't know what this is in basketball, all of the college teams are sort of ranked from one to however many, and then the top 68 teams or so are all put into a tournament, and each of them are given sort of a seeding or a ranking, if you will, based on what they're, how good everybody thinks they are versus how bad they think they are, and then they match them up accordingly. So if we were to do a seeding this morning for all of y'all in the room, what would your seeding be? Let's just say there's 300 people in here. Where are you in the room if one is, when I think of Jesus, I think of you, all the way down to, I can't believe they even let me in here. Like, just kind of, if you were, we were to rank you all out, everybody kind of have their tournament seeding. I mean, who's going to be the blue bloods in the room, like North Carolina, Duke, Kentucky, Kansas? Who is Oakland and Charleston and James Madison, all the others? Where are you at in sort of that? Just kind of think of a number somewhere between 1 and 300 where you think you would kind of lie in the seating. Look around. Get a good look. Probably be inappropriate if I had a few of you stand up just to kind of help out with other people's rankings. But I'll just kind of let you look around really good and kind of get that in the back of your mind as you think through where you would land. All right. So take that number, whatever that number is, lock it somewhere in the back of your mind. If you have a really poor memory, pull out your phone and just put it in there. We'll hopefully get back to that before the end of the service. Otherwise, if I don't, you'll be like, what was that all about? I digress. All right. So in that opening clip, how do you get somebody to move to the place where they move from hands in their pockets, not thinking about anybody else other than themselves, to sort of open-handed and helping and thinking about other people? How do you get somebody to that place? Does it take a near-death experience? Does somebody literally have to come within the brink of the edge of their life before they move into that place? I mean, do you have to walk them out into the oncoming traffic before they will move to that place? Is that what it takes? Well, I don't know. That's the age-old question. Because we know that in our hard wiring, somewhere in our nature, is we're very self-focused people. At the same time, we have this great need and desire to be in community, to be in relationships, to we can't live life in isolation. The greatest punishment that we give anybody in America is solitary confinement, right? So we know that we're social people, yet we are incredibly self-focused people. And the greater degree to which you're self-focused, the greater degree to which you'll find yourself isolated, because nothing will clear a room quicker than focusing on yourself and being nothing but a taker and making everything all about yourself. That will really push people away instantly. So how do you move from one place to another? This question is something that comes up over and over again. We do all kinds of experiments with this, live experiments, especially if you've ever seen parents with kids. They start the process of socialization, and they think that their little child will just naturally get along with others, forgetting the fact that we are hardwired to be selfish. And so we put them in a room with somebody else's kids or maybe in preschool for the very first time, and we fully expect that they will play nice with others. They'll be gentle, they'll be kind, they'll share toys, and they'll enjoy, and they'll do group play. Only to find these screams and the yells coming in from the other room. And sometimes things are so quiet, and the reason why they're quiet is because in a room, you ever seen, like, maybe one of your kids, in a room full of, like, 30 other kids, your child's playing by themselves? What's with the antisocial behavior, Johnny? Doesn't have any clue what you're asking. Or they'll just hoard toys just for the sake of hoarding them. I mean, I remember my kids, they'd put toys under each arm. They'd be walking around the house like, just because they didn't want anybody else touching their stuff. Kids as young as 2 years old will resort to physical violence, right? You ever seen them shove and they push, and then they move to this move right here, whether they even have, they don't have good aim, but they at least have the mindset that you come near me, you're going to get the skippity-paps, you know, you get off of my stuff, right? And so that continues on, and you're trying to continue the process of socialization and teach words like share and love and care and gentle and kind. And so the socialization process, those things oftentimes fail. So then you begin to think, well, maybe the greater degree to which you love someone, the greater degree to which you'll be more selfless. And so at some point, you get to the place where you are so in love with somebody, you think, I'm going to spend the rest of my life with that person. We're going to do marriage, right? And certainly the love that we have for each other will move us out of this self-centered existence into this communal existence that'll be wonderful, happy marital bliss, that all the poems and all the things that the pastor says at your wedding are all talking about this idealized life. Only to find that you are more like a preschooler when it comes into marriage than you ever were before. I mean, are you not really? Do you not have the sense of, why did you take my stuff? That was mine. I was there first. That's my car. Why are you in my car? Why'd you leave dirt in my car? This is mine. That's yours. We all have this possessive stuff that goes, this is my room of the house. This is where my things go. You don't put your stuff here. No, you don't take that. That's mine. That's, I keep that one nice because it's mine. You don't touch. Is that not any difference than in preschool? You know, or perhaps maybe you're thinking to yourself, well, maybe that's why social media is so appealing. I mean, after all, it sort of purports to give you everything you always wanted, right? You can have social interaction, but you can have it at your terms, right? I can talk to who I want, when I want, and how I want. I can control how much information you learn about me and the things that you know about me. I can curate my image, so I purport the good image that I want. I can do it on my timetable, so if I'm a morning person, I can communicate in the morning. If I'm a night person, I can communicate at night. If I get to the point where I don't like you or don't like the things you say, I can instantly either remove you completely from my sphere, or I can just ghost you for a while and kind of put you on cold, right? And then, you know, it's all good. It's all kind of how I want. But if COVID taught us anything, it's that social media might well be a good complement. It might be a good complement for real social interaction, but it's definitely no substitute. Because when all you have is the book and the gram and the snap and the Zoom, things just aren't really all that great after all, are they? We were all yearning for having some kind of personal experience with other people. When our churches were shut down and schools were closed and the offices were all shut down, there was this yearning, this desire to be around other people. And so there's sort of this question is, how do you have communal relationships when you're so self-focused? And so some people might think this is just really bothering me. Sometimes this just doesn't go right. So how do we have good relations with other people with all of our self-focus? Well, I know, church, that's the answer. We'll get some Jesus in our life. We'll go to church, and God will take care of it all. But then you think about the process by which you used to even end up here in the first place was what? You shopped around for the best church to meet your needs. That's what we do, right? We go around and we evaluate. Some of you this morning are taking evaluation Sunday and you're checking things out. Most of you all probably check things out before you even came, because the last thing you want to do is waste an hour of your morning on a place you haven't looked at before. So you'll check out the website, you'll peruse around and see if this might be something that I like, and want to make sure that the pastor, you know, he teaches the truth. I want a guy who teaches the truth and preaches and calls sin, sin. Just not the sin I'm dealing with, not the stuff I'm struggling with. Don't get too close to home for me. And I want to give, but I want to make sure that my giving is going to go to maybe put up a better program for my kids. Because as long as my kids are taken care of, if you're going to use that money so that my kids get a better experience, that's worth me giving to. And I really want to help other people, but I was frustrated to find out that I couldn't take any selfies when we were feeding the homeless because, I don't know, some kind of thing that they don't like their picture being taken or something like that. But that's really going to mess up my social media image if I can't get any pictures out of this. And are there any vacationary opportunities? Because I really want to vacationary somewhere exotic and nice so I can really be a help to people as I vacationary somewhere. You look at this, like, that's not any different than all of your other social interactions. No wonder there is no change. It seems like as if you're just kind of replicate everything else you've done everywhere else. And if you go back into the early church, back when the church first formed, these were all the issues they were dealing with back then. As a matter of fact, Paul, when he's writing his letter to the church in Corinth, they were struggling with all of these selfish issues. These things were all coming out. Everybody was so self-focused. And the question comes up, how then do you move from this self-focused attitude to one that is conducive for relationships in the community and the desire that we have to live in harmony with one another? And Paul has a lot of things to say in there. Of course, he moves everything up to chapter 13, where he's like, if you guys would just love each other, that would solve a lot of your problems. But he really hits on one of the issues in 1 Corinthians 10:23. And it's apparently he's probably taught them a lot about what Jesus Christ has done to fulfill all of the requirements of God's law, that we don't have to that being accepted by God isn't a matter of, you know, the number of rights and wrongs you do and your good outweighing your bad. Rather, it's all about God having a loving relationship with you, and that's freed you from the legalism of having to cross everything off and what I can or cannot do. And so he addresses this, and he says, you guys keep on saying, you're so big on saying, this is 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 23, I got the right to do anything. But hey, let me remind you, not everything is in your best interest. I mean, just because you can doesn't mean you should, right? You've heard that before, and that's what he's telling me. Just because, you know, oh, is God going to, you know, keep me from going to heaven if I do this? No. Oh, is God going to banish me to hell for eternity if I do this? No. Oh, well, then why not do it? You know, I'm just saying, it may not be in your best interest. You know, God's not going to send you to hell for getting wasted, but why do you want to hug a toilet in the morning? I'm just asking the question, is it really in your best interest? Is it really in your best interest to do that? I just don't think it is. You know, is it right or wrong? That is a good question, but maybe a better question is it really even good for you? But then beyond that is probably even a better question to ask. He says, you know, you guys are all focused on, you know, whether or not you're allowed to do something. He says, further, not everything is in the best interest of the people around you. Some of your translations will use the word constructive, or it's a word which means not everything that you can do will build each other up. So probably the better translation is, not everything that you would do is in the best interest of other people around you. So sometimes you're so focused on what I am or I'm not allowed to do, you don't think about what impact this is having on other people. What impact, sometimes you think about this, about the impression it's having on your kids, but what about everybody else around you? What are they going to think? How is this going to impact them? Maybe they're struggling with this area, and if you're doing something that they're struggling with, if you're doing something that they have a problem with, isn't that going to have a negative impact on them? So it's not just about right and wrong. Sometimes it's about what's in your best interest or the interest of other people. And so he's trying to get them to think about other people beyond themselves. And the question then, of course, comes in, how do you get somebody to get to that place? And this is the conundrum Paul had. So to get you there, I kind of have to go through an explanation of something that, you know, I've been struggling through and working through in my own mind. Maybe you'll understand, maybe you won't. The reality is, if you come in here this morning and you say, I believe in God, I'm not denying that. I'm just saying there's a difference between believing in God and truly knowing God or having a real encounter with him. What I mean by that is most of us believe in God that is in some way, shape, or form heavily influenced by our own thoughts, our own ideas of who we are, maybe some of the things we've read, other previous concepts we have of God. And so you believe in God, but I'm not quite sure you fully understand God. There is a sizable difference between you and the reality of God. And we oftentimes will elevate where we are in relationship with God unknowingly. To illustrate this, or to kind of, this is a little bit of a scatter this morning. To illustrate this, years ago, there was a guy named Brian Scalabrine. If you don't know who he was, he played in the NBA for 11 years. I'm not really sure I'd say he played in the NBA. Better to say he was on an NBA team for 11 years. He spent the vast majority of that time on the bench. Came to great fame when the Boston Celtics won their championship with Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce, Sam Cassell, Ray Allen, those guys, that whole crew that kind of brought the glory days back to the Celtics. Well, Scalabrine was the first one off the bench, not to play, but to get up and cheer for his team. He was on the bench, and he always get up, had red hair, big, tall guy, waved the towel around. I'm sure he was probably good in practice to play against because they always like to have big bodies they can practice against. And a lot of fans kind of grew a little resentful of this kind of big, dorky-looking guy on the bench because, I mean, the guy got championship rings, and he got to celebrate with the team, and the thought was kind of, I'm better than he is. Why don't I get to be on the Celtics? And this was a pervading sentiment throughout the area, across the country. And so one of the local radio stations in Boston, one of the sports radio stations, 98.5, did something they called the Scallenge, in which they scoured across the greater Boston area for the best non-professional basketball players, the kind of people who were calling the radio station saying, I'm better than he is. I could take him any day of the week. I can't believe this guy's even in the NBA. He stinks, yada, 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 right? So they brought him in, and so they went through, and I don't know how they determined the best of the best, but they got the four best guys they could find to go one-on-one against Scalabrine. First one to 11 points wins. The combined scores of all four games was 44-6. Scalabrine smoked them all. I mean, it was either 11-0, maybe 11. I think the best anybody got was, I think, 3 points on them, and that was it. I mean, that's usually, and they always got to start with the ball. So a lot of these guys were just chucking up, you know, deep shots because they got anywhere near the hoop, they'd get swatted. And what that showed was this. You may think that because you play in your local gym and you dominate that competition, that you're only this, you know, you're this close to making to the NBA, right? But what that showed is you were this far from the guy who doesn't play at all and just cheers for his team on the bench, right? And that guy is, we already know he's all the way to this far away from being Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, right? That was evident. And you were thinking just because the superstars on the team were that much better than this guy, well, I'm probably here, you know, if Scalabrini's here, and they realize, no. You were only getting a few mercy points, deep shots, that's it. I mean, it was embarrassing. To say that even some of these guys got 2 or 3 shots, this is no different than when I would play my kids in basketball when they were young, and, oh, it's a close game, son. Oh, you got one. I mean, sometimes Scalabrini wasn't even playing defense because he's like, yeah, go ahead and shoot out there. I'm going to get the rebound, right? Oh, no, you made one. Funny. Okay, now I'll play defense. Okay, you're not going to score anymore. That's the way that whole thing went down. In other words, when they had a true encounter with an actual NBA player and had an accurate comparison between them and NBA talent, all of a sudden there was a humbling that they experienced. What they thought the comparison was compared to what it really was, and then the realization of what it would actually be between where you are and what an actual starter would be, and then from that to a superstar in the NBA. There is a big, big, big gap. There's a lot of people in the Bible who believed in God, but you'll notice when they actually have an encounter with God, something changes. So for instance, Job, we read this whole story of Job, and Job spends weeks on end. Granted, he goes through a miserable experience. He goes through the suffering and death and loss of children. He loses all of his wealth, his finances, his health, horrible experience and time. And he has got a relationship with God, but he's very frustrated, very angry at God. And he kind of cries out, and he's like, man, I just wish I could have a conversation with God and ask him, what gives, man? Why am I going through all this? I wish I could just give him a piece of my mind. You know, I wish I could, you know, go to court, take him to court, and put on trial. But the problem is the whole thing would be rigged because, I mean, how do you prosecute God when he's the judge and the jury and the defendant, right? I mean, how are you going to get away with that? It's a rigged system, he would say. I mean, but if I could just get my fair day in court, then I could give God a piece of my mind. That's his mindset throughout the entire book, right? And then God finally does show up and has a conversation with him. And he sees God face to face, and he has his scallenge moment, if you will, with God. And it says at the end of the book of Job, he says, I know you can do all things, and no purpose of yours can be thwarted. You came down and asked, who is this that's daring to question me? Why don't you sit down and I'll talk for a minute? My eyes had heard of you. Sorry, my ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. He says, I repent in dust and ashes. There was a humbling experience coming in contact with who God is and seeing him face to face, having a real encounter with God as he actually is. Isaiah has the same experience or a similar experience in Isaiah chapter 6. Isaiah is a priest. I mean, he's the best of the best of the people. And he comes into the temple one morning, and the last person he expects to ever see at church is God. But God, sure enough, is there, and he says, I walked in, and I could see that just the edges of God's garment was filling up the entire temple. I mean, that's how massive God is in this moment. And he says, at seeing him. Now, Isaiah, you have to keep in mind, he was a great orator. He was a great speaker, and he would speak out, and he would preach to the people and tell them the words of God. That was his gifting, was speaking. And he instantly looks, and when he has this one encounter with God in Isaiah chapter 6, he says, woe is me, I cried, for I am an unclean man, and I've got unclean lips, and I live among a people who are unclean. He is undone. He is shaken. He's like, he realizes just how utterly sinful he is in the presence of a holy God. And he has this encounter. He says, whatever you want me to do, wherever you want me to go, God, I'll do it. I'll do whatever you want, because I just realize who I am before you. I will go anywhere. I will serve in any way, any capacity. Later on in Isaiah, we read things about how he fully understands now the skies and the scope of who God is. So, for instance, I don't know if you all read this. I was reading an article about a supernova, something that's about to explode. Well, when I say about to explode, it exploded 77 years ago, but because it takes 77 years for light to travel to Earth, sometime in the next week or month or so, we'll be able to see the explosion, right? And that's a pretty near star, actually, in the galaxy of ours, because it's only 77 light years away. It's, you know, a small pittance to the actual size of the galaxy, or, I mean, and then beyond that, the universe. And yet Isaiah says that God stretches out the heavens. I always think of my dorm room when I was in college. You know, the old joke in college was, should I put the poster over here or should I put it over here, right? Because that's most of the rooms I lived in when I was in college with two people living in them, you could stand in one spot and touch both walls, right? That's how small the rooms were. And God says, I can stretch out my hands to the ends of the universe, a size we don't even sure how big it is. You know, a size that it would take 70.